Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this panel on retail CBDC and its implications for the European Monetary Union. Today we'll be exploring the motivations, implementation strategies, design and different roles of the Central Bank, Ministry of Finance and private sector in introducing a CBDC in Europe. I'm Kate-Chan Wilson, Head of Policy Analysis at the Digital Monetary Institute here at OnFit, and today I have the absolute pleasure of introducing my esteemed panel, perfectly suited to share with us their latest thinking on Europe and retail CBDC. We have Dorit Dieser, Head of Digital Finance, Payments and Cybersecurity at the Federal Ministry of Finance, Germany. Constanze Jagami, Head of FinTech Sector at the Supervisory Institutional Relations Directorate at the Bank d'Italia. Charlotte Hogg, CEO of Visa Europe, and Wolfram Zeidemann, CEO of G&D Currency Technology. Welcome to you all. And welcome to all attendees from across the globe. We have an excellent audience of key stakeholders in the CBDC development, stemming from central banks from all over the world, payment service providers, commercial banks, technology companies, and other institutional investors. We want this discussion to be as interactive as possible. So if you do have any questions throughout the discussion, please do let us know through the chat function on Swapcard and I'll bring them in and direct them to the panelists. We've also got a couple of polls, which you can find in the chat box. So I encourage you to vote on those throughout the discussion and we'll bring them up. We're looking at today, what are the biggest challenges to implementing a digital euro? There's a couple of options you can vote on. Clear policy objectives, incentivizing intermediary adoption, consumer adoption, concern of crowding out the private sector, legal questions, and any technical challenges and any other options you think. We don't think we've covered them in that. And then a second poll, does Europe need a digital euro to protect its monetary sovereignty? Let us know your thoughts and we'll discuss it with the panelists. So now moving on to the panel. Just a little bit of background. We know that the ECB has officially launched its digital euro project, marking the end of the examination phase and the beginning of this ambitious 2-year investigation phase. Hi, Charlotte. With the potential to launch in 5 years' time. This will take the ECB one step further than I think the 86% of central banks said to be researching CBDC currencies. But there's still so many questions around business model, whether we even need it, and the role and its role in payments, which we'll explore today. So to start us off, I think on any discussion on CBDC, we really should explore wider context of payments habits and cash usage before we discuss implementation. If I could just pose a question to the regulators on the panel first, starting with Constanze, what would you say has been the impact of the pandemic on European payment habits broadly or Italian payment habits? What are the trends towards cash displacement and how is the central bank responding?
Okay, thanks. First of all, let me say hello to everyone and thank you for this invitation. Well, as far as Italy is concerned, we are experiencing an increase in the use of electronic payment instruments. This trend has been accelerated by the pandemic. It has increased the use of e-commerce, so e-commerce purchases, and the use of electronic card payments, also for in-person transactions. For in-person transactions, we are assisting also at an increase in the use of contactless technologies, mainly to, avoid physical contact and because of the risks of contagion due to the pandemic. As the Banca d'Italia, we have published in July of this year a report on the impacts of the pandemic on the payment habits of Italian payment users. And what we've seen is that these trends, which have been increased by the pandemic, should be maintained in the future, because also thanks to answers to surveys that have been made, payment service users have, have responded that they have the intention to keep on using such payment instruments also when the contagion will finally be over. So what we are seeing is a decrease in the use of cash for payment purposes. And we've seen also that this is a trend that's common to European countries. Of course, cash displacement is, let's say, a different rate in the different countries because we started also off from different situations. So while some countries in Europe could be considered really close to a real, let's say, cashless society, this cannot be said, for instance, for Italy, because what we've experienced also, which could seem, let's say, in contrast with what I said before, is that there has been in the last year an increase in the amount of demand of euro banknotes. But let's say a limited amount of these banknotes has been actively used for payment purposes. So let's say this has been, I would say, this has mainly the purpose of using cash as a store of value, especially because it's the most liquid asset to which people turn to, especially in crisis periods. It ensures privacy. It ensures the possibility of no-cost transactions. So it ensures financial inclusion. So what we're seeing is that despite this digital revolution we're experiencing, cash and other forms of digital payment instruments will coexist in the near future. So cash must continue to be supplied, and it must continue to be accepted widely by merchants and businesses.
Thank you for that. Very interesting that you think that the trend will be maintained and the use of cash as a store of value. Just want to ask you if you think of any challenges then to this landscape. What are some of the potential threats of the big tech coming in, and any regional initiatives that you can think of that are working on this?
Well, on let's say on trying to avoid fragmentation in the European payments market, which despite the progresses that have been made recently, is still an issue that needs to tackle. The Eurosystem has, for this purpose, just recently published a retail payment strategy in order to, let's say, to support the creation of pan-European payment solutions and to support innovation and digitalization in the payment systems and to also, let's say, exploit and fully deploy instant payments in order to help and help the use of digital payment instruments and reduce, as I was mentioning before, fragmentation. So all of these challenges should be supported also by market-led initiatives, which should, in a way, try to meet the objectives that the European Payment Strategy has set. And so the creation of, let's say, a pan-European payment solution governed at European level, and also, let's say, fully deploying, as I was mentioning before, instant payments and ensuring safe and secure payment systems for everyone throughout the Union and throughout Europe.
Thank you, Constanze. Doris, can you expand a bit for us on maybe the payment habits in Germany specifically and how important this is for the Ministry of Finance and your response?
Yes, Katie, and thank you very much also from my side for having the possibility to join today. I actually could refer to a lot of things Constanze just mentioned, which is quite similar in Germany here. Of course, the pandemic has affected all our lives everywhere. It has changed the way we worked. It has changed the way we buy and sell things. And of course, it then affected also the way we pay. And we had similar developments. We had an increase of e-commerce, a decline of cash payments. We had more digital payments. At the POS, the point of sale, we saw more card payments and we saw more contactless payments. And I think most of these developments will continue. So how did we respond? of course, from the policy side, when it comes to payments, we always have also a kind of European response, because the payments area is nearly fully harmonized from a legislation point of view. So one immediate response one saw on European level was a quite technical one. It was the lifting of the strong customer authentication exemption for contactless payments from 30 euro to 50 euro, which was actually one of the consequences of the increased cash payments due to the pandemic. And in longer terms, it affected the way the payments topic is perceived also on political level. It got more and more important. The political strategic implication of payments got more into the focus. And suddenly politicians saw that payments is not only for exchange for getting services and goods, but it's also a kind of one could basically say infrastructure which is essential for a functioning economy in Europe. And therefore more and more attention got paid to the market situation, where we see, especially when it comes to pan-European, where we see quite a fragmentation. That's what Constanza also mentioned. We see few pan-European schemes, but we see a lot of national specific schemes, which basically end at the border. So, and that is why this competitional perspective got more and more important in this respect, and it got more and more attention from the policy side. And that is why we now see things like a joint statement of member states supporting pan-European payment solution. The idea behind that is that to foster competition on pan-European payment solution would be for the benefit of all of us, customers, consumers, merchants. And there it could be done more probably.
No, definitely. I think one central banker we previously spoke to referred to the attitude previously before the pandemic of, if it's not broke, let us not fix it. So there was an element of complacency there. But I think the move to political and strategic implication of payments is really, really excellent point. So Wolfram, you've just heard from regulators that the current European outlook for retail payments, you've heard the trends, and I think you understand the technical offering of CBDC better than most. Do you think the EU needs a CBDC? Is it a solution to some of the changing behaviours and needs that we've just heard?
Well, I think this is one of the key questions that we all try to find answers for currently. But if we look at what's happening in the world, and you've heard it from the speakers before, that on one side, public currency is in high demand. On the other side, since many business models become digital, there is a high demand for convenient payment solutions in the digital space. And of course, a digital currency, which would be a digital format of public currency, could be a interesting platform with a huge potential for network effects, and therefore also for creating efficiency, avoiding fragmentation, enabling innovation, and I personally believe it could be the driver of the digital economy in Europe.
And do you think, though, because if you compare the decline of cash in Europe to other regions in the world, do you think it affects the use case more than other regions like Asia, where, you know, there's a massive shift to digital, even more so than what Doris and Constanza have just described?
Well, worldwide, we see the debate is showing different motivations. And we touched upon some of them already. In emerging markets, the main motivation to offer a digital public currency is financial inclusion. Since we have not achieved that in the private sector yet, And since all private business cases or payment solutions are business cases targeting a certain market, but I think this is a question that Charlotte should talk about. We see clearly the need in developing economies to achieve financial inclusion, and CBDC could be a tool for that. In Europe, the situation is slightly different because we have multiple choices. As a consumer, you can pay with cash, you can pay with cards, with mobile payments. So there are a lot of choices. However, still we see that some consumers are critical. And when businesses move into complete digital space, currently there is the only chance to pay there is if you subscribe to a third-party contract. And that means you have to accept a fee or a data sharing structure, which many users, especially in Germany, where privacy is a key concern, are not completely happy with.
Well, that's interesting. It's the interesting reluctance to subscribe to a third party offering. It could be a key factor in the implementation. Charlotte, what about from your perspective, based on your experience of a well-established payment network like Visa, where do you see the role for the digital euro in terms of use cases and also within the wider ecosystem?
So thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to participate. I mean, I do go back to the comments that I made earlier. There's no question that over the last couple of years, we've seen an enormous embracing of digital generally in all of our lives, and where payments have enabled people to shield, you know, virtual food banks to be created when the physical ones close, or series of innovations around digital. And I think if anything's become clear is that pace of change hasn't slowed down, and that when we think about inclusion in this world, it has to be about digital inclusion. And I think historically we've talked about, we've made sort of access to cash synonymous with financial inclusion. And the challenge for all of us now actually is to think about digital inclusion more broadly. I'm a big believer that there should be a whole range of choices and alternatives in payments. We, none of us know, have a crystal ball as to how this is going to evolve, or what the use cases are. But I completely agree with the ECB and other central banks' position that now has to be the time to explore this issue. And that's really for three reasons. One is we've talked about, we are seeing in some markets a decline in the use of cash. Cash is a very important form of payment for key sectors of our population. It's also one of the few things which carries our nation state in a physical form. And so the reduction of that is important. And it's important symbolically too. The other piece is developing a central bank digital currency for retail. Of course, we have it in wholesale. It's hugely complex. It's going to require different capabilities at a different level than central banks have traditionally had. There's a very powerful, I think, paragraph in the ECB's paper around central bank powers going, you know, not beyond, i.e. thinking them as limited. And then it goes into topics of cybersecurity, technological innovation, customer service, and all these other elements. It's complicated. Right? It's going to be complicated from a security point of view. It's going to be complicated from a fraud point of view. It's complicated from an acceptance point of view. Where and how do you use it? And it's going to be complicated to not determine or predetermine the use cases and have it as an element of choice. And when something is that complex and it's going to take a range of different players to participate, better start now to really think through all of those issues rather than waiting to the point where we think, gosh, we have to put something in place over the next year or so. And I think the last thing I would say is clearly technology is evolving. And it always has done. But the job of us all, and particularly for policymakers, is to continue to navigate through using the same frameworks and thought processes that we've always done. How do you create a competitive environment? How do you create something that's secure? How do you create something that consumers recognize and value? So I think now is a really important time to look at this. It isn't just a question about payments, right? It's a question of how we all live our lives and how we include people in what is increasingly a digital world. These are complicated questions. None of us know the answers, so we better get cracking on it.
I think your point on not quite knowing what the use cases are yet is an excellent one, because if you ask people if they want it, they don't really know what they want yet because they don't know what's possible.
And that's been true throughout history. There's a lovely story, and I never know whether it's apocryphal or not, but of ice being shipped to Europe from North America in the kind of 19th century, and the focus is all on improving the ships. And meanwhile, someone's inventing the fridge and the whole world changes in terms of their use case. So my point being, and I don't know whether it's true or not, that story, that none of us have the privilege of understanding what the future holds. So creating new capabilities and choices for consumers. I mean, what I do know is that none of us wakes up every morning thinking, today I'm going to pay, right? What we think about is, I got to get to work. I got to get on public transport. I want to think about my holiday for next year. All of those are experiences that payments in some way enable. And actually, you want different things from them at different times. When I'm getting on a metro, I really want it to be quick, because there's, you know, hundreds of people behind me waiting for me to get through that barrier. When I'm buying a holiday, actually, we know people have valued the fact that they've been protected if it's had to be cancelled over the last number of years. And so, again, choice is not just about lots of different rails. Frankly, I don't think consumers care so much about that. It's about all the value that you add around a money movement to deliver the experience they want in their lives. And therefore, we've got to enable that more open, more thriving, competitive environment. And clearly, this is an important moment to think about that in the context of CBDC.
Yeah. Can I add something here? Because I think that rightfully hits the point. CBDC is not about designing new use cases. It's not about creating new business models. It's about defining an instrument that can be a platform upon which such use cases can be developed. So I think the task of a central bank is to provide the infrastructure. No one thought about in what way cash would be usable if cash was designed. And business model evolve. And if you look at current markets, not only that the consumers are to be addressed, but also there's a lot of new markets currently developing. If you only look at the DLT infrastructure that's currently being built, there are new business model evolve, but we need to think about what could be a payment instrument in a digital space that can be offered by a central bank as a platform that allows then various businesses to make use of it. And currently we sometimes have a little bit of that joint discussion. We always look at business models and business cases and designing payment into it, which happens in the DLT space currently. But we should differentiate and decouple the business case and the business model from the instrument.
Maybe to just jump in here and add something. Yes, I think this is one important point the two of you mentioned. I think there's another one which comes along with the discussion of CBDC, and that's the question, first of all, which part can a CBDC take over in a whole or holistic ecosystem of digital payments? And that is what you just said, really gives a good option for that. But there's a second point which goes along with CBDC, and that's the question, what's public task and what's private task? And if you perceive CBDC, I think one of the main positive things about CBDC is that it's a legal tender for digital payments. And I think from a public perspective, it is very important to offer people access to legal tender, also in a digital world. That is less about competition and market innovation. It's more about the people's access to something they really can trust in, so to say. Of course, they can also trust in commercial banks' money. However, and that goes along with the development of the decline of cash. As by now, the only access people have to legal tender or to central bank currency are banknotes and coins. And if banknotes and coins got less and less accepted in the world because the world is getting more and more digital, There could be also public need to offer your people and public solution of legal tender for this digital world. So I think this is also very, from a political point of view, from a policy point of view, a very, very important aspect which CBDC could solve. And the second or the third one to add would be the international role a CBDC or a digital euro could have. And I think this is one of the big challenges we are also facing. How we make sure that we are not get left behind and by the developments which take place in other areas of the world. And of course, everyone is aware of China and the developments there and their ambitious plans. But we also see developments in much smaller countries all over the world and in South America. And if you look to Africa, which I personally think is very interesting at the moment, you see the e-Naira, and the e-Naira surely has the main purpose to include, financially include the people living there. However, with regard to the technical point of view, it's also quite innovative. And I think we can see a lot of these things happening everywhere in the world. And of course, Europe or the Euro system needs to have an answer to these things as well.
If I can step in as well on these issues, I wanted to highlight the importance also stemming from the comments that were made before of the need to ensure, let's say, proper cooperation, coexistence among the public and the private sectors in the potential issuing of CBDCs and the role of CBDC. It has a public policy role, as Doris was mentioning before. It can be seen as, cost-free for end users, payment instruments, so an additional means of payment for merchants and for businesses. So it has some policy implications, as was mentioned before, playing the role that cash plays for, in the physical world, as CBDC could play that same role in underpinning stability and trust in the digital payments ecosystem. So I would say that one of the main issues is to ensure cooperation between private and public sectors on these issues.
Thank you, Constanta. That actually leads us nicely onto looking more into the roles of the public and private sector. But before we move on, we've had an interesting question from the audience. They say, do you think that the European Payments Initiative or the digital euro would have happened without the impact of COVID? What do we think about that? Charlotte or Wolfram?
Well, I mean, the work that central banks have been doing has been accelerating for some time. I know personally the Bank of England started on it several years ago as sort of new technologies emerged and they began to look at the impact on the decline of cash. And clearly, right before the pandemic, central banks across the world were already starting to work on these issues. I suspect we all of us are in different ways thinking about what does this acceleration to digital mean and where do we need to accelerate what all we're working on? Certainly in our case, thinking about all the tools and services and solutions consumers are going to need in a world where payments in a way are becoming more and more invisible. As you walk into a taxi or you pre-book, you don't stop to pay anymore. And in a world where open banking is beginning to take off, the tools that you can offer consumers around how they make choices in their financial life, what information you can provide them with, all of that has been evolving. Now, it's clearly been accelerated by this move to digital in all its formats and all its form factors over the last couple of years. But it seems clear to me that central banks are already rightly and appropriately thinking about these issues.
Yeah, I also think that COVID was an accelerator that showed us that we not can only, enjoy the convenience of digital offers, But it actually showed us that we actually rely on it. We rely on digitization in today's life. Otherwise, we couldn't have events like that. We couldn't work from home. We couldn't purchase online. So in that sense, COVID really accelerated existing technology trends tremendously.
Certainly. So I think a mixture of yes and no to that answer. And then just another one from Banque de France, which I think is relevant while we're talking about sort of objectives and even timeline. Do we see a risk of putting CBDC into the market in about 5 years or more with a potential market that's overwhelmed with private digital currencies? But I mean, Constanza or Doris?
Well, if I can start, I think that there are many issues that were mentioned also before that need to be tackled and addressed in deciding whether to issue or not a CBDC is the main reason for the need to, let's say, investigate, clearly the design and the distribution that CBDCs could have and address all these possible issues through the various phases through which we're going through. So as you all know from the report of the ECB on the digital euro, there has been a public consultation, there has been an experimental phase, and now we're in the investigation phase. And after that, after, let's say, all these main issues regarding the design and distribution are addressed, which are key issues to, let's say, properly decide whether and how to issue the CBDC, then at that point, we'll also have to take a note of the scenario. So the decision will have to, will benefit also, I think, from the time that in a way will pass in order to see if some possible, situations do actually exist or persist. So if cash displacement does increase, if there are, other aggressive forms of offerings of other payment services. So just to be sure that when the decision will be made, it will really take care and take into consideration the situation that we're living in.
And you don't think there is a concern it will just be too late? Because you have to take into account all the different scenarios before. It's too risky to do it earlier. Is that?
That's, it's too risky to do it earlier, and it has to be, many technical issues, not only policy issues, have to be, deeply analyzed. And when everything will be ready from, a technical point of view, then at that point we will see what the scenario is and then decide on the opportunity of issuing it or not.
I think it's worth bearing in mind in Europe too, both the categories of different crypto capabilities as they exist and also the place that we start from. So, I know in this debate we're not getting these issues muddled up at all, but often in the court of public opinion, people muddle what they call cryptocurrencies, which really aren't their assets. Then the different use case of stable coins, which I agree with an earlier speaker, is probably less relevant in a market with a very stable currency, and then a CBDC. And, there are different characteristics of fiat currencies around the world, their reliability, their sustainability, their role as a reserve currency. And Europe is, in a very strong position in terms of the euro and the other European currencies, in that they properly fulfill fiat currency roles, store of value, means of exchange, unit of account, in ways that some other countries don't. So I think as speaker said this, there are very different environments around the world, and we all live in our own context, and it's worth recognising that as we talk about particularly digital Europe.
Doris, did you want to come in?
Just to add what Constanza said, of course timing is crucial for the acceptance of a CBDC. And of course 5 years are quite a long time when it comes to digital developments. So, and we have to be aware of it, that when we are ready, or the ECB is ready with its work, that it's still relevant for the market. So, yeah. However, Constanze already mentioned the challenges, and another challenge is that when you're a public authority or a government or a central bank, for several reasons, you can't maybe act as fast, agile, or iterate your business model on the market, tested, retested, and they say, "Oops, that it didn't work. Sorry," because here we are talking about public trust and the trust in public authorities. And what do I want to say? When they go on market, it has to work. There's not much room for failure here when it comes to such a solution from a public authority.
Exactly. You can't take it back once it's done. And Charlotte's point on context, I think, is excellent. Let's move on now to how central banks can work with the private sector more. We know that the ECB's launched its Digital Euro Advisory Group and it's co-opting views from practitioners on the role and the value of the euro. How can the private sector play a role in this and the development in this long 5-year phase until we potentially launch a 2-tier retail digital euro? Wolfram, what are your thoughts on the role of the private sector here in this phase?
The private sector is essential in a successful CBDC ecosystem. And I think the debate rightfully starts at the central bank to make up their mind what their role they would like to maintain in the digital space. But they should invite both the financial markets as well as technology provider to engage in that debate on developing use cases, developing business models, developing new products and services. Because if you look at the finance industry today, by introducing new technology and CBDC can be used in these new technologies, there is a huge potential to gain efficiency. And that allows to operate in a different way, save costs, focus on innovation, and come up with new products and services. And I think the most important first step is to create clarity of what is a CBDC. It's not that the central bank offers accounts to the general public. It's not that the central bank creates blockchains to implement new business models and use cases. But it's the obligation of the central bank to offer a platform that allows them to issue a value in a digital format, excuse me, and ensure authenticity of that value. And then it's upon the private sector to define the use cases, to issue the wallets, to integrate wallets into automated supply chains, to offer new products and services for the consumer. And that requires an intensified debate of how can we use the digital euro in new markets, but also in existing applications. So I think we need to intensify that debate between the central bank as a driver of developing the infrastructure and the private sectors to find their ways in defining innovation and finding their role in a new environment.
Excellent. That's very clear. Central bank, the infrastructure, the private sector, the sort of added value business models. But Charlotte, what role will Visa play or other major payment systems currently in the CBDC system?
I mean, there's obviously a number of roles, but where I differ from the point you just made is I think when it comes to fraud and security. Because when you have cash today, in a sense, it's a vertically integrated technology, right? That the prevention against fraud is embedded in the note. It's in the design. It's in the whether you choose paper or plastic, it's embedded in the note. Equally, acceptance, i.e. where you're able to use it and how you're able to use it, is embedded in the note. It's carried on the note. Now, in a digital world, those things do become more complicated. So to protect against fraud, you actually need global data, because unfortunately fraudsters are no respecters of boundaries at all, to protect against cybersecurity in a world where hacktivists are ever more innovative themselves, again, needs, I think, increasingly global data and global talent and probably global infrastructure. I'm not a buyer that, you know, there's a new technology coming along that will solve all of our problems forever and we don't have to worry about these things anymore. I think there's a lot of interesting capabilities that come with DLT and DeFi and blockchain, but I doubt that it's the forever solution. So there are some really important fundamental issues around security, infrastructure, availability and fraud, where engaging with the private sector to understand how they think about these things, the level of investment that's required, the kind of talent you need, the kind of data you need, how you use that data, is going to be an important first step. Because I think there's a Maslow's hierarchy in payments. And the bottom of Maslow, as you know, is water, fire, air, security. And for payments, it's still security. And only then, when you've got the fundamentals in place and you're confident in that level of credibility that will drive ultimately the financial stability objectives that all economies have, can you get to the use cases? And so when you ask kind of how should we play, I wouldn't say, you know, don't worry, we'll just come up with the use cases. I actually think the fundamentals are the most complex pieces, and where there are certainly lessons learned from the private sector, if not sets of services that can be leveraged. And then you can get to structures. And I agree with what's implicitly been said in this is open structures, more participants, more ability for different use cases to emerge will be really important, because there's one thing we all know in the digital world is create a single point of failure, create a single point of risk.
But how do we get to that point then, do you think, where I think you're saying we need the expertise from the private sector even now on the fundamentals? Do you see this happening quickly enough?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think a really important first step was taken with the G20 principles around the CBDC that, in a sense, reflected all the thinking that's taken place up to now to then create some guardrails as to how we should think and pursue this. I thought the principles were really strong, including the kind of do no harm to existing financial stability and monetary policy objectives and create competition. And then, you know, across the world, we see experimentation, but we also see real engagement with the private sector and real openness. It was in the ECB's paper on a digital euro. It's in the engagement that the Bank of England is doing. It's true all over the world. So as I said at the very beginning, the reason why we need to start thinking about this now, and colleagues on the panel have rightly said this is complicated, could take a long time, is because it raises issues that are solved in cash, because cash is a vertically integrated stack.
And do you think, though, you've mentioned security, what about privacy? Do you think privacy is as complicated, or do you think we've made some leeway in that? Because I think if you look at the Reichsbank or the PBOC, what they've done this kind of pseudo anonymity where they can see the transactions, but not the identity of the people. Do you think there's still a lot to be explored there, or do you think we've kind of...
I think the G20 principles are helpful, and what the RICS are doing is very much what we do in payments, right? We don't know your name and address. We have a 16-digit figure that is encrypted at rest and on move. But there's actually some very important questions that then come around ethics as much as privacy. You know, under what circumstances is it appropriate to use even the data that you have, for what use cases? What kind of access would you give consumers to their data? What kind of choices would you give them? How do you demonstrate that every time, even that transactional data is used, that it's used to create value? And one of the things we've done at Visa is look at all the kind of ethics frameworks that are emerging around the world and establish for ourselves a set of principles around data ethics that go beyond the privacy that's embedded in GDPR, which we've already implemented. But when you live in a digital world, particularly in a payments world where you're using this information in very short spaces of time, so you have to be using AI and machine learning to protect against fraud, it's very important that you have a clear set of values as to how you're going to do that, that is transparent to those whose transactional data that you're using. So I think there's work to do on ethics, again, private and public sector combined, and in the context of the broader society we live in and what consumers think is okay and not okay.
I think you brought up a very interesting analogy of CBDC to cash and the cash system. It's even a bit more complicated if you look at cash, since there's an entire industry ensuring the security of the cash cycle. It's not just the instrument itself. It's also protecting the way how cash is moving around in the cash cycle. If you make that comparison to fraud in the digital space. But of course, in the digital space, it's more challenging. And here, again, the industry, I think, needs to work together to ensure that the entire CBDC ecosystem is well protected from a security perspective as well. Talking about privacy, I would even go further than your suggestion. And again, make the comparison to cash. In the cash environment, a payment between two people is a private situation between the two of them. And I would like to maintain that situation. If we talk about public currency, we don't need to have third-party involvement who has access to any data. So in order to design a truly private solution, we should even not collect data. And that's possible. Of course, we need to, on the other hand, make sure that there's AML in place and there's Know Your Customer procedures and then compliance in place. And we can ensure that by not excluding the financial sector, the commercial banks, out of the CBDC ecosystem, because they have established all these procedures. But for a low threshold, in my opinion, there's no need to collect any data who is paying and the amount that person is paying at all. And that's the challenge that we have in CBDC design, that we need to close that paradox of offering a complete private journey for a very low threshold of value, but on the other hand, to offer a registered journey through the financial system if you want to trade with higher amounts comparable to today's situation.
And if I may, well, this feels to me that's a public policy choice as to where transaction thresholds start and stop. You know, we know Gresham's law, bad money drives out good. We know that unfortunately things like terrorism can be done at very, very low denominations in volumes in a digital space. And so I can totally appreciate the perspective you have and the connection to cash. But this is an important public policy choice, and there are pros and cons with wherever you set this line. And that's why I think we're both agreeing probably that there's actually a lot of thinking, a lot of work to do on this topic that policymakers really have to gut into because of the unintended consequences of where you set these thresholds.
Doris, Constanza, anything to add or anything to add, I think, more broadly on this issue of data and maybe creating a level playing field in the EU? And I think we're verging on the territory of these wider questions of the roles of non-banks and fintechs and data and competition policy and how they all interact. I mean, Doris, from your perspective for the Ministry of Finance, how do these issues all interlink and what's the role and responsibilities of yourself and colleagues?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, of course, increasing importance of data for any business model is nothing new in the digital world. And what I found quite interesting here is that we are somehow, as financial market and payment experts, are quite focused on specific financial markets and payment solution, say also payment legislation. With the European legislation, a quite good framework with the PSD2, and which got be supervised now, and of course has to take these kind of questions in its supervision into account, the questions, the access to data. However, I think it's really important to also focus on the cross-sectoral developments here. So, and we have a lot of commission proposals which are coming in place here. We have the Digital Markets Act. We have the Data Governance Act. We probably will soon see a proposal for a Data Act. We have the GDPR especially. And these are all cross-sectoral legislation which can immensely affect what is allowed or not allowed in payments. And I think this is something we should be really be aware of, also as policymakers, so to say. When it comes to big techs in payments, maybe to come to that question, or to non-banks in payments, maybe this is kind of started. Non-banks in payments per se are not really new. That is why we have PSD1 and PSD2 to have the possibilities also for non-banks, so-called payment institution or e-money institution, to offer payment services. So, and these risks are mainly prudential risks that got addressed by this kind of legislation. What is new now is that we see basically service provider outside the, which are not focusing on one specific business model as, for example, the acquirers do, but which come from a totally different area. They come from the area of, from other business areas, for example, e-commerce area. And they start, now start to offer payments as a kind of add-on service to their main service or their main business model. And these kind of things really have to look what are they offering and what are they doing to get the risk right and then to rightly address it. So what we've seen from typically non-banks as acquirers is they are mainly prudential risks and they could be covered by prudential regulations. Therefore, payment institutions all need a license and are supervised by financial supervision authorities. When it comes to big techs, at the moment, what we see on the markets, at least in Germany, is they are kind of playing different role. They are mostly the interface for the customer. However, they are mostly not involved in the transaction itself at the back end. So now you can ask yourself what are the risks that go along with this front end services. And these are different. There are less prudential risks. There are more cybersecurity risks, data protection issues, and competition issues. In a way. And the question is, how do we address these things best? And there, as I mentioned at the beginning, we already have some good regulation. We have the GDPR as a cross-sector regulation. We have some other cybersecurity regulation on European level there. However, we have rarely or barely financial market, specific financial market regulation here. And I think this will be one of the big questions for the Commission. And the next and the review of the PSD2, how far these services may also have a specific financial market risk which needs to be addressed.
And what about, I mean, just briefly, the risk of CBDC, you know, pushing out some of these other innovations?
Oh, I think that I could refer what we had at the beginning of the discussion. I personally see it as an ecosystem where, of course, CBDC can play a role. Of course, you still will need other financial market players for maybe keeping a wallet, doing the KYC and AML obligations. Well, I think a lot of could be feasible there. I mean, we see, and if you look at the big techs, what they normally do at the moment is that they embedded an existing card scheme or an existing payment service of a traditional bank at the back end to then transact. And depending what will be able there, I think that will determine more the way these actors participate or do not participate in the market. Yeah. I think it's quite interesting. Charlotte can probably tell more about the project or Visa's announcement to may issue stable coins on credit cards. I think these are the kind of projects which are getting very interested and could be also interesting for big platforms.
Of course. Just briefly before we move on, Constanza, we've had a question on the impact on banks. in the CBDC world? I mean, there's quite a lot of research that's been done on this already, but what do you think is left to discuss about this? I mean, we've talked about caps before and those sorts of things. Do you think there's still, is the central bank still concerned about the impact on banks in general? Or do you think that?
I would say that more than concerned, it pays great attention to this. Among all the issues that need to be properly addressed, there is also the role of banks and the impacts on bank deposits of the issuance of CBDCs. So the way the whole architecture will be actually developed, the role of banks, the incentives, both as we were mentioning before, the caps on amounts or possible disincentives in holding, let's say, over a certain amount of CBDCs, and limiting, I would say, the use of CBDC as a payment instrument and not for other purposes, are all the issues that are really carefully being evaluated and need to be addressed. CBDC is, I would say, it's a public good. It's not something that wants to change the way the structure of the financial system now. So there is no intention of having intermediaries lose, let's say, their positions, their activities, and the way they perform their business. So it's something that needs, as we were mentioning also before, cooperation. Yeah. It needs to be really designed in a way to avoid negative consequences on credit institutions.
Thank you for that. I mean, we are running short of time. There's a lot more that we could talk about, but briefly, this does come up a lot. What about the role of programmability? I mean, Wolfram, I know you've written on this, so perhaps we'll come to you first. Can you just explain what we even mean by a programmable digital euro? What is the role for it? There's a lot of confusion around the term.
Yeah, programmability is used in a context of creating automated payments. And I think here a digital euro should be possible to be used. It shouldn't be confused with the assumption that the purpose of the general purpose of the digital euro could be restricted by a program. So it's very clear a euro needs to be a euro, needs to be a euro, and it's stability that it presents and not programmability. So that can give the wrong impression. However, we want to make the digital euro usable in digital business models where automated contracts are being executed. And that goes in line. I mean, my vision of a CBDC is the picture that I already described, a platform where the central bank issues the value and then the commercial market issues the wallets that can be used in various business cases, person-to-person payment, even in an offline environment, person-to-machine payment, even machine-to-machine payment, where programmable wallets need to be used in order to be integrated as a software development kit into a, for example, blockchain design of a digital business. And that would open up new markets to the euro where it would be used. So when we talk about global competition of currencies, I think that's a very important feature that a digital euro needs to have if we want to use that historic chance to design a new format of money.
Thank you for that. And I think that plays into the theme of the panel very well, which is how can the digital euro, you know, impact the monetary union, but how can it support it? How can it push integration and growth and the EU's competitiveness internationally?
Exactly. Becoming the driver for the digital economy. And this is what we currently are testing with a few central banks, where we prepare pilots that are not only addressing the general public, allowing for financial inclusion in remote areas where offline payment is key, but at the same time also inviting fintechs offering new payment services or a new digital business model that can be used with the same platform. And these experiments will be really exciting because that's a very strong concept of how CBDC can look like.
I think that's a great far-reaching way to end. I only wish we had more time. There's so much more to discuss in this area. I'll just briefly tell you the poll result, which is interesting. 31% of people said that the biggest hurdle for a digital euro was clear policy objectives, 19 consumer adoption, and then 15 incentivizing intermediary adoption. So very, I mean, actually we're quite reflecting what we discussed earlier on the panel, which is actually we still need to define what we're doing here and why we need it. And then 77% of people said that we do need a digital euro to protect monetary sovereignty, which is similar to the result we had back in April. So everyone's keen that we need one. We just need to realize why, I think, is the conclusion. But thank you all. This was an excellent discussion. Please just stay on and join us for the next presentation. We have Daniel Hardman from SICPA discussing, again, this role of privacy and compliance. And then 11 UK time, we've got the future of EU's capital markets and wholesale payments. Thank you all for this excellent panel and have a lovely rest of your day.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.